recorded.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us for Wealth Management Group's Market Update. This morning, we are joined on the phone with Craig Bolanos, founder and CEO of Wealth Management Group. Craig, the call is yours.
Lisa, thank you very much for joining us on today's strategy session, which we've appropriately entitled, From the Crisis Emerges Change and Investment Opportunity. And I was taking pen to paper last night preparing for today. You know, I started to contemplate how we're all eventually going to look back at this pandemic and see it in hindsight. Because with that, we can maybe get some perspective into what the future holds. And I just think that history is made by momentous events, both good and bad. But events that define an era, well, they are nothing short of loud thunderclaps that echo and shake things well after the first lightning bolt flashes. And this pandemic, well, it's nothing short of such an event. I mean, it has hit and will hit previously distinct issues hard, cause them to veer in different directions because of it. And I almost hearken back to September 11th, 2001, that grave day, you know, one that affected air travel for a time, but security at airports was changed permanently. And even more broadly, you look at those ripples. 9/11 affected policies on Iraq, energy, and many of those still resonate today. And with that same mindset, we can see these waves, that these big waves, you know, they push storms onto our future shores. And I think this pandemic is going to affect U.S. elections, complicate many domestic and world issues, just as previous recessions did, maybe even more so. And while this pandemic has greatly damaged our immediate living standards, depending on where you live in the country, and it could be worse to come if it was poorly navigated, but on the other hand, it could spark innovation that will be so beneficial long term. And these effects, I think they're not just difficult to forecast, quantify, and maybe even total. But, you know, there's numerous net negatives that are near term, but I remind people there could be positives and investment opportunities long term. You know, but for now, we just don't see a reason at Wealth Management Group to change our stance, which is we're always optimistic about the long term, but we're still cautious near term. We want to wait to better gauge this pandemic. I want to be sure we're identifying the issues that intersects those, you know, that could be positive, negative, or neither for investors. You know, and again, there's uniqueness here because unlike many of the other recessions, this social and economic crisis, it originates from a force of nature rather than that just as forces of man. So our preferences remain in place for now, owning higher quality credits, that's bonds, along with growth and defensive equities. And it's that word growth that leads us into today's discussion, because I can't think of another firm, bar none, that was more affected by the events on September 11th, a firm that on that fateful day had tragedy ensue, but answered the bell, answered the call, rose from the ashes, and continued and has done what they've been doing so well for the last 50 years, which is to uncover companies going through positive dynamic change. And we're pleased to be joined by Bradford Newman from Alger Investments. Many of you know that the Wealth Management Group has a long history with Alger. Alger's widely recognized as a pioneer of growth-style investing with headquarters in New York City, along with affiliated offices in Boston and London. Brad's a senior vice president, director of market strategies at Alger. He earned his degrees with distinction from Emory University. He's a CFA charter holder, a member of the CFA Institute, and you might certainly recognize Brad's voice as you've heard him time and time again on CNBC and other publications. So with that, Brad, thanks for joining us. And I made reference in my opening remarks as to how Alger rose above and is nothing short of a shining example of that through which we celebrate, you know, the triumph of the human spirit. Just as it seemed dark back then, to many, it might seem dark now. Can you share with us for just a moment before we talk about the investment landscape, what occurred at Alger on 9/11 and how your firm has made this resounding, remarkable comeback?
Oh, thanks, Craig, and yeah, I'm very happy to be here. Thanks for having me. Yes, September 11th was full of tragedy for Alger. We lost 35 employees, and including the CEO of the firm, and basically everyone in the building, including the entire investment team, perished that day. The only people on the investment team who survived were those people who were fortunately out of the building and, you know, meeting with companies and doing their job outside of the office. And we were lucky enough to have some kind employees who had worked at Alger, who were kind enough to come back to the firm, had a lot of loyal clients who stuck with us and built the firm back up. And I'm happy to report that, you know, we're record assets under management, nearing $30 billion today. And, you know, what we like to say is the culture was so strong and so pervasive that if you looked at the very strong returns in the decade before 9/11 and the decade after, you wouldn't really see much of a difference. So, yeah, we're pretty proud of how we made it through that.
No, absolutely. That's to be worn like a badge of honor, meant to be celebrated, and it's part of the reason we're a very results-oriented firm, but, you know, we're proud to be affiliated with such a deep-rooted, positive American culture. Now, Brad, you know, investors, we like to put labels on everything, whether it be the economy, the financial markets, and a lot of the labels we tend to use begin with adjectives like the word, you know, great. The Great Depression, the Great Recession. Now people are calling it the great lockdown. Well, you know, at times what I continue to hear from people and gets discussed is maybe we've moved into something else that we might call great, the great disconnect. You know, how can stocks have rebounded so strongly over the month of April amid so much, I don't know, suffering and economic damage? Because the speed at which the U.S. stock market went from all-time highs to deep bear market territory was nothing short of breaking all historical and statistical records. And then the rally that ensued last month, well, unless I'm mistaken, you know, it was the best rally, the strongest since early 87. So why does that perception of that disconnect exist?
Well, you know, so I think directionally, we'll talk about first. Directionally, I think the markets actually been very rational. So, you know, I've said since the beginning that the leading indicators for this recession are different than the traditional ones that you look at. You know, traditionally, us economists and market strategists, we look at things like surveys on industrial production, Institute of Supply Management, for instance, is a big one, or we look at, you know, retail sales as one of the first things to move in the economy, those kinds of things. Well, in this recession, I think the leading indicator is really everything to do with the virus in terms of transmission, hospitalization rates, death rates, all of those things. And what we've seen is actually this play out on kind of a rolling basis around the world, you know, in Asia, China, and then Korea went through this kind of first and came out first, then Europe, and for a while we were tracking Italy very closely and some other large countries, and now those countries are beginning to open up and have their schools open in many cases, like Denmark and Austria and Germany, manufacturing and retail, so forth, and you know, we're behind them. So I think the market saw this framework and how the virus had peaked in our country in terms of you know, the per day infections, and looked at that framework around the world and said things will be getting less bad. And when the market that typically sees things getting less bad, it begins to rise off the bottom. You know, in fact, in China, and I'm not saying China is a perfect template for us, but China auto sales, just for the people listening, as a good indicator of how their economy did, was down 79% in February. And then Chinese auto sales were down 43% in March. And in April, they're actually up 4% year over year. So I think the market is discounting an improvement in the economy, which, based on what's happened around the world, and actually if you look at, I think, real-time data, I personally think that there's no question the economy has troughed. Now, whether the actual level of the stock market is appropriate, that's a different question. But directionally, I think it's been rational.
No, thank you for sharing that. And that's great perspective, especially looking overseas when they started the curve a little bit before we did. So, you know, before we talk about some specifics, I want to touch on S-curve. I want to touch on oil. There's a number of other items that I really want to get into, but just, you know, break it down a little bit more, maybe from a view of 5 to 10,000 feet. What is Alger's outlook for the second half of 2020 and beyond?
Well, you know, we think that the second quarter is going to be, you know, the trough in terms of GDP. You know, if you include yesterday's data that was reported, 36.5 million people in the U.S. have filed for unemployment in the past 8 weeks. And officially, that so far has only pushed the unemployment rate up to 15%. I personally think it'll go well north of 20%. And that'll be approaching, if not potentially exceeding, the Great, as you mentioned before, Depression. And so that's going to take global GDP down 3 or 4% for the year, I think. Now, that doesn't sound maybe so bad to people listening in, but it's twice as bad as the global financial crisis. And the U.S. will likely be down in terms of GDP something like mid-single digits for the year, and possibly down as much as 30 to 40% in the second quarter, which, again, I think will be the trough. And earnings for the S&P 500, I think, will be about, right now they're already about $130 per share for the S&P 500, down from $160 last year. And my guess is those numbers will move lower. Again, the second quarter being the worst. The first quarter was down about 14%. The second quarter will be down significantly worse than that, and then the third quarter will get a little bit better. You know, but we see some reasons for hope. First off, on the stimulus side, the U.S. Federal Reserve has increased its balance sheet, meaning how much money it's printed and put into the system, about $2.6 trillion since the end of February. That dwarfs what they did in the global financial crisis in 2008. And U.S. fiscal stimulus is about $4 trillion if you include some of the leveraging they're doing, which dwarfs, again, what they did in the global financial crisis, which was only $800 billion. You know, we see people starting to move around a lot more. So people weren't allowed to spend at retail stores in much of the country in March and April. So about 3 weeks ago, only 7% of the U.S. was not under stay-at-home orders. Today, that number is more than 80%, including as of today, Friday the 15th. Many parts of New York State were just opened and moved into phase one. And according to Apple's data, they track how much people are moving around, and the mobility of U.S. citizens in terms of their driving is up 20% so far this month, although it's still down more than 10% below the pre-pandemic level. So people are starting to move around more, and the stimulus is, I think, filtering in to some extent. You know, I mentioned that I think that we'll follow some of these other countries and, you know, as a loose template. And improve. And as far as, you know, retail sales came out this morning, you may have seen it was down 16%. And you'd be excused for not knowing this. It sounds like that number means it was down 16% from a year ago in April, retail sales. They were actually down 16% from the prior month. That means March, you know, which is like a nearly 60% rate for the quarter. But I'm pretty confident that that number will be the worst number that you see. It was, of course, a record low, but we think that'll improve going forward. There's a lot of data that shows us that's the case. Bank of America reports credit card spending on a weekly basis, you know, credit card spending for their customers, and that's already improved to some 10 percentage points since the end of April. So I think that'll improve. So we're looking at, you know, a difficult year compared to 2019, but a year that's better in the second half than the first half.
No, thank you for sharing that. And there was a great video that you published that one of our team members had circulated within the office. You know, I think it was entitled Oil Plunge Points to the New Economy. Would you feel comfortable, you know, citing and just sharing those three things that you listed in that video?
Sure. You know, I posted the video because I think a lot of folks out there were stunned at how low oil prices were going. And if you recall, oil prices actually went negative. And, you know, I from clients I spoke to, there was a lot of confusion about what's happening in the oil market and how is it possible that there would be no value to a barrel of oil. And so we cited kind of three things that were responsible for that decline and tried to explain why oil went negative. So first off, why would investors or end users ever pay to sell oil? It sounds crazy, but they did. And it's simply because they have nowhere to put it. So as the May futures contract expired and contract holders were faced with either taking physical delivery or selling at negative prices, many had to sell because they couldn't store the oil. The storage was sold out. So there was no other option than selling it at whatever price was left over because of the storage situation. And why was storage sold out? Well, that brings us to the second point. There's been a tremendous amount of demand destruction in the U.S. and all over the world that's wrought a dramatic oversupply in the oil market, and particularly in the U.S. So about 40% of oil demand comes from cars and trucks, and with, you know, as you can tell, with nearly no, almost no one on the road, combined with plummeting factory production, there's nowhere near enough demand to sop up the supply of oil, which has increased in, you know, over the past decade significantly, partly because of some new technologies and what the U.S. has done. So that was the second point. And the third point we made, and this is kind of gets into kind of Alger's specialty and innovation and what we see changing in the world. So that's the changing nature of the economy, in our belief, in our view, is making companies less dependent on oil. So our view is that data is the new oil. And as the digital revolution accelerates, oil demand will be secularly challenged, keeping a lid on prices. So those are the three things that we cited in the video.
No, and I think, you know, that's almost a great segue, because, you know, so many, you know, some of your remarks today on the surface, but, you know, the other things we talked about behind the scene is, you know, how this pandemic is actually helping to create some themes that, you know, improve some themes that you guys are investing in. And you've talked before about what I deem to be the age of connected intelligence, and several of the data points, I think four or five of them specifically, that are prevalent within that theme, the age of connected intelligence. You just mentioned, you know, that oil is no longer the commodity that it once was, that it's maybe been supplanted by something else. Can you talk about those points in the age of connected intelligence and how you're thinking about that from an investment thematic and deploying capital?
Yep. So, you know, I think a lot of the media and a lot of investors are focused on the various cycles. So, you know, whether you're focused on the economic, traditional economic cycle, you know, from boom to bust, recession to recovery, or whether you're focused on the political cycle, obviously we're in an election year, or whether you're focused on, you know, central bank tightening and loosening of monetary policy. There's a lot of cycles to focus on. So at Alger, we don't manage money around those cycles per se. So in other words, if we think we're going into a recession, we don't all of a sudden buy defensive stocks like utilities. And if we think that the economy is going to be great, we don't rotate into what we would call early cyclicals like retail stocks. We take the cycle we look at is a much broader cycle. It's these cycles of technological revolution. And there's been some academic research that suggests they happen every 50 years or so. So we're focused on this much bigger picture cycle that we think generates real wealth, and all the other things that the media and some other investors are focused on are kind of just noise around these really important cycles. And so, you know, to give you a flavor for what the last cycle was, you know, most people think that, most of these researchers who subscribe to this idea think that the last cycle, we'll call it the age of, you know, telecommunications, started in, normally starts with a big bang, and in this case would be 1971 was the introduction of the Intel microprocessor in California. And of course it ushered in the, you know, the personal computer revolution. And then, from that, there, we, financial markets discovered it in the second phase, after, the first phase of eruption, which is the innovative part of the cycle. The second phase is called the frenzy, when financial markets kind of discover these innovations, and then the bubble pops eventually, and that was obviously the popping of the tech bubble, and that's the inflection point. And then after that, you get the last two phases, which are when the innovations really help productivity, and then finally the maturity phase. And so we think we just started a new cycle, because the last cycle ended, you know, you could kind of tell with mobile phones, we got tremendous productivity out of everyone having access to all the knowledge in the history of the world at the palm of their finger, in their palm. But if you look at global smartphone shipments today, they're actually not growing anymore. So we think that cycle of telecommunications is over. And the new cycle we call the age of connected intelligence, because we think it's transitioning to a world in which data, as I mentioned, is the new oil, and it's all around us, and smart devices integrated into our lives, you know, maybe even on our bodies, like smart watches and eventually other types of smart clothing, and our cars, you know, like Teslas with much more computing power and able to sense the world around them. All of these devices we call the Internet of Things will be communicating with each other and processing with much greater intelligence, artificial intelligence, to help us make better decisions, essentially. And so that's how we view this current cycle that we're in. And then if you want me to, I can go through some of the, you know, big themes within this revolution, and
most definitively, I encourage you to share those. You know, I think we really like to bring sincere and actionable ideas to people. So please go ahead.
Okay. So, you know, and these are some of the things I'll mention some of the things that I think have been accelerated by the pandemic, and fit into this whole theme. So, cloud computing may be the most obvious one. So cloud computing, just to define it, because it sounds kind of like something mysterious, it's kind of the renting of computer hardware and software as a utility. So instead of you in your home or you in your small or medium-sized business trying to purchase, you know, the best computer and the best software and maintain it yourself, cloud computing allows you to essentially rent those computing services from large platforms or utilities. So, you know, we say the computing power and software is in the cloud, which just basically means it's somewhere else. You don't own it. You rent it. And as the world moves more digitally, and you can think of this in your own life, which has probably dramatically changed over the past couple months, whether you're simply entertaining yourself with streaming video that comes from the cloud, or whether you're working from home, you know, as I am right now, and telecommuting, you're accessing that data through the cloud. And so cloud computing is growing tremendously, and it's a more flexible and more efficient way to access that technology than what we call on-premise, which is when you or business owns it. And so the pandemic has accelerated the move to the cloud through remote work, video streaming, whether that be business communications or entertainment that I mentioned, and other activities such as, you know, the use of virtual tours within the real estate industry. So Telecom Italia commented recently that internet usage was up 90% during the pandemic. We've seen the same thing in the U.S. and other countries. And so the beneficiaries here include some of the cloud-based platform providers that Alger invests in. So Amazon is the largest cloud-based platform in the world, followed by Microsoft and Google. But it also benefits other companies that sell products to support their operations, such as the chip and semiconductor-related equipment makers like NVIDIA and Applied Materials. Again, some stocks are owned, some of those stocks are owned in some of the Alger strategies, and then of course there's all different types of software that allow you to access that data. You know, cloud-based software as a service, we call it, that we invest in as well. So that's one, you know, giant theme is cloud computing. You want me to keep going and mention some others?
You know, yeah. Share with us two more, and then I want to talk about some other things that come up in client conversations just to seek some understanding. And then I've got a closing question to sum us up. But share with us two additional themes besides the theme of cloud computing.
Okay. So so cybersecurity. So, you know, when you think about all this data that's being transmitted all over the world and how data is now so valuable, if it is indeed the new oil, securing our digital information is paramount. And in this pandemic, we've observed that security has proven to be a non-discretionary item for firms because they view it as an area that is difficult to cut back on even under economic duress, because if, you know, they're not trusted by their customers, then that can mean the end of their business. So we've seen some very strong results from some of the companies that we invest in cybersecurity. I'll mention in a second. But so as more sensitive information is stored and transmitted digitally as a result of our increasingly virtual workloads that I was talking about before, we think that cybersecurity investment is likely to increase. And furthermore, as enterprises increasingly use the cloud-based technology that we were talking about to conduct their business across more endpoints, meaning, you know, more computers and devices that they're that people are accessing their data with, they need cloud-based security services that are flexible enough to keep up with their businesses. So these cloud-native, we call them, or cloud-based cybersecurity solutions, like one good example is a company called CrowdStrike, they're likely to be the winners in securing data across the enterprise. And again, this is an area which we think will grow irrespective of you know, economic volatility, just like cloud computing. And then the third one I would mention, I think, you know, I mean, I don't know, I could choose from a few here. And maybe I'll let you choose, Craig. Why don't we talk about e-commerce, which is fascinating what's happened to behavior recently, or would you rather me talk about healthcare?
I think I'd rather you focus on healthcare because, again, you know, the story that is pandemic, you know, that is COVID-19, it is healthcare related. So why don't you share that thematic with us?
Okay. So there's a lot in here, but, you know, so over the past decade, the cost of sequencing a genome has declined over 90%, and that's fueled all sorts of innovations. It's, again, it's part of this explosion of data because now we're able to access all of this data that's in the genome. And so scientists have greater insight into the genomic causes of disease. And those insights can open up treatments and even cures to diseases that may have previously been unimaginable. For example, after receiving the genomic sequence of the coronavirus, researchers were able to design a potential vaccine in just 3 hours. And traditional processes for vaccines would have taken, you know, many months in contrast. So the global progress made with regard to the coronavirus, we think will spur increased interest in bioengineering, creating a tailwind for the software and hardware and materials used to analyze and manipulate genetic code. So some of the companies that we invest in that provide the software, hardware, and materials to do this type of work are companies like Biotechni, which is kind of a small to mid-cap company that provides a lot of the organic materials to be able to conduct some of this research. Danaher, which is a company that provides not only some of those materials, but some of the equipment for life sciences research. Illumina might be another good example of a company. They're the leader in the machines that actually do the genetic sequencing. And then, yeah, additionally, just on the healthcare front, we've, you know, social distancing has helped accelerate the virtualization of healthcare delivery through telemedicine. And combined with electronic medical records and robotic assisted surgery, we think technology will increase the productivity of medical professionals. And I think we're seeing that through some of this virtualization that's been accelerated here in the pandemic. Yeah. So those are three themes I'd highlight.
No, I appreciate you sharing that very much along with all of your comments. And, you know, and I'm just reminded by a frequent conversation we have is there was so much, I don't know, we just saw so much. It was unprecedented data points relative to market volatility. And some of those numbers that we saw in March relative to VIX, well, good heavens, they were higher than that through which we saw during the 2008 financial crisis. Can you talk for just a moment about sentiment on two fronts? What I call VIX, you know, how we saw a dramatic rise, I think all the way up to 80. What does that even mean for investors? I mean, that was more than 2008 by a long shot. And now we're back to 27. So talk a little bit about that concept of VIX. And if I'm not mistaken, while that VIX was rising to 80, we did see some unique activity from what I call various company insiders. You know, what is an insider and what have they been doing?
Yeah. So, you know, we think sentiment is a great contrarian indicator at certain levels. So first of all, just to define what VIX is, in case anybody on the phone doesn't know, it's the implied volatility with an S&P 500 option. So basically, the more that investors are paying for options, the more that they're essentially betting on volatility being high. And that typically increases when investors are nervous. So they're paying a lot of money for protection, for instance, on puts, and they only do that when they have higher anxiety. And so, Craig, you're right. We saw the highest VIX level on record in March. It hit over 80, higher than the global financial crisis. And around that time, interestingly, the market bottomed. And what we've shown through over 30 years of data is that as the VIX increases, in other words, from higher levels of the VIX, you actually get higher forward return. So, for instance, if VIX is 20 to 30, your returns are lower over the next 1 and 3 years than if they were 30 to 40 and still lower than if the VIX was over 40. So over 40, VIX historically has meant a one-year return of 32% for the S&P 500 and a three-year return of 58%, which, of course, is much higher than average, you know, which over a one-year period would be in the high single digits. So when the world is very nervous, shown by high VIX levels, that's often a good time to invest. I know that's counterintuitive, but that's how it's worked historically. And I think with the VIX coming back down under 40, it makes us, you know, less bullish from a macro perspective in the near term. Doesn't take anything away from purchasing equities for the long term, but I think if you're looking at that indicator, there's just less anxiety out there right now in the market. And then, you're also right about insiders. So we view them as a good, not a contrary, but just a good indicator for the underlying value that's out there in the stock market. So an insider is an executive of a corporation, whether it be a CEO, a CFO, or a board member. And we track whether they're net buying or net selling, and most of the time they're net selling. And the reason for that is because, you know, they're getting awarded stock as part of their compensation, and they want to, you know, rightly so, diversify that over time. And so normally they're selling, but occasionally we see insider buying on net. And recently we saw a record net insider buying. Our data goes back to 2004. And so that was a bullish sign to us that the insiders, the executives at these companies who know how much their companies are worth, were buying their own shares. And it's been a pretty good indicator historically. For instance, you know, back in the global financial crisis when insider buying peaked, the S&P 500 was up 33% in the next 12 months. And then similarly during the kind of European crisis in I think it was late 2011, early 2012, when insider buying again peaked, the S&P 500 rallied 21%. Over the next 12 months. So when we saw it go to an all-time record in our data earlier this year, we were pretty encouraged. Now, it's since subsided as stock market prices have risen, and it's back down to kind of flattish-type territory for the S&P 500, although it's still net positive on balance for small-cap stocks, which I think is interesting.
Now, I appreciate you sharing all of those things, you know, and to that extent, you know, I loved your comments earlier where, yes, based on all that's happened with COVID-19, the market, even though it didn't seem such, was probably very rational. Whether the level of the market is appropriate, that's an entirely different conversation. That being said, I think your comments relative to the age of connected intelligence, where data is likely the new oil, I think that resonates with many in the environment that we're in. And certainly, at the Wealth Management Group, we're going to continue to bring to all of our clients cutting-edge ideas to help everybody focus on what's ultimately important, which is getting retired and staying retired. Brad, I thank you for your time. I appreciate the wisdom that you shared with us on today's strategy session. And to any and all of our clients and prospective clients, if you want to learn more, if you have follow-up questions, reach out to us at the Wealth Management Group team. We thank you for your business. We appreciate the opportunity to be of service to all of you. And with that, Lisa, I'll let you conclude today's call.
Thank you, Craig. The opinions voiced on this call are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. The economic forecast set forth may not develop as predicted. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Securities are offered through LPL Financial, member FINRA, SIPC. Alger Investments are not affiliated with Wealth Management Group or LPL Financial. Thank you.